I'm Rebecca Lavoie, and welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. Today, we're talking about episodes 3 and 4 of the team's latest series on John Brookins, who's been in prison for decades for the 1990 murder of Sheila Ginsburg. If you haven't listened to those episodes yet, this conversation may not make a whole lot of sense, so make sure you go back and listen to those episodes before listening to this addendum. My guests today are Karen Brookins. She's an advocate for and the wife of John Brookins. She's created a change.org petition for John and immersed herself in the case so much that she's been able to track down witnesses. She's also working to change legislation around wrongful convictions. Karen, it's nice to meet you. Welcome to Undisclosed.
Thank you, Rebecca. Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Craig Cooley. He's a solo practitioner and sole proprietor of Cooley Law Office. He's been investigating and litigating significant felonies for the last 20 years and has helped overturn more than 20 cases based on new evidence of innocence. His work has been profiled on 2020, 60 Minutes, NBC Nightly News, and Investigation Discovery. His work has also been published in numerous journals and law reviews, and he co-authored a wrongful convictions textbook called Miscarriages of Justice, Actual Innocence, Forensic Evidence, and the Law. Craig, it's a pleasure to talk to you. Welcome to Undisclosed.
No, ditto. It's a pleasure to be here and to talk about John's case and to John's innocence. And I love what you guys are doing. You guys have impacted a lot of cases, so we're hoping we get the same result with John's.
And finally with us is Colin Miller, my favorite legal Siri. He's an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law. And of course, he's one of the hosts of the Undisclosed podcast, and he's the one who's been digging into this case. Hey, Colin.
Hey, Rebecca. How are you?
Good, good. I have questions for you later, so hold on to your hat, okay?
Sure.
So I'm going to give a quick summary of episodes 3 and 4 to remind our listeners what they just heard. In episode 3, the Undisclosed team reported on Tammy Stroman's claim that she drove Sharon Ginsburg to and from her mother's apartment complex on the day she was murdered. Kathy Rollins' claim that she saw Sharon in her mother's parking lot with bloody hands on the day of the murder, and various witness claims that Sharon confessed to murdering her mother. In episode 4, the Undisclosed team discussed the tactics employed by the detectives investigating the case, John's petition for DNA testing of items including the gloves found in Paul Cotman's car, the possibility of a pardon, and John's use of yoga and meditation to heal himself and others behind bars. Craig, I'm curious, how did you first become aware of John's case and eventually come to represent him?
Karen. Short and sweet answer. No, I believe she contacted me probably 2 years ago. I want to say November of 2018. And, you know, having worked for the Innocence Project for a number of years and done these cases for a long time, people call me all the time and they write me, and my loved one's innocent, please listen to me. And it's tough to go through a lot of those cases, but I heard Karen out. She sent me the stuff, and when I saw that 6 witnesses testified on John's behalf that another person had actually made incriminating statements regarding Sheila's murder, I said, okay, there's something here. And that's basically it. Karen's diligence in trying to find an advocate for John. And so all the success goes to Karen at this point.
So, Craig, I'm sure you have a high bar for wanting to work on cases, right? Considering you get so many requests. What are some of the other measures that you use when evaluating whether or not to take on someone as a client?
Well, in John's case, it was my background with the Innocence Project, really, because I started to look at what the theory would be in terms of DNA testing. So at the project, when we would take cases, we would sit around with the intake team and the staff attorneys, and we had one criteria, regardless of how much evidence was against the defendant, was there a theory of DNA testing that if the stars aligned, it would prove the client's innocence? And John's was pretty simple. It's called a redundancy theory. If we could get Sharon's DNA on the scissors, Sheila's clothing that was pushed up, her sweater, her t-shirt, her bra, maybe the trophy, if we could get those, you can get a redundancy, a double, a triple, or a quadruple redundancy. That's your theory of innocence, and that's what's required under the DNA statute. And once I saw that, in more of the investigation, but my initial focus was on the physical evidence. Hmm.
I'm also curious, how has John been as a client? You know, I've talked to a lot of attorneys on this podcast about what it's like to represent somebody they believe is innocent and who is proclaiming innocence. And it really ranges from, you know, this person is relentless and tireless and calls me every day and every night. This person is really helpful. This person, you know, is desperate. I mean, what is it like working with John? How is he as a collaborator on this case?
I have a lot of clients who will call. John doesn't call me often. Karen does, which is fine.
Good for you, Karen.
I'm annoyed. That.
You need people, because attorneys, if you're a good attorney, you're going to be busy. I mean, that's just the truth. That's the reality of the world. I mean, if you don't have too many clients, you're not doing something wrong. So, but having an advocate like Karen pick up the phone and call you, and it's just the nature of the beast. When you do this type of work, I know I'm going to have family members, friends, relatives call me and say, want a status or send me leads. So working with Karen has been great. John, again, he doesn't call often. He knows that Karen's out here. We're out here. Mark and Marty are on his side. The Georgetown students are out there. So it's been a collaborative effort. And John just... when I need information, I mean, I'll talk to John, but a lot of times I can get it through Karen. And so he's not really hands-on, but he's involved.
Now, Karen, we've heard a lot about your advocacy for John in the podcast. We haven't heard a ton about your relationship. I would love to hear how you met and just tell listeners like everything you want them to know about what your relationship with John is like outside of the advocacy that you're doing on his behalf.
Okay, I love talking about that part. John and I met as children. We met as young kids in church. We used to go to the Salvation Army Church. Many people don't realize that that is a church, but it is. And we met there as young kids. He was a Boy Scout. I was a little Sunbeam, which is kind of like the Brownies. And he would sneak down the hallway. He would ask the scout leader if he could go get a drink because our room was right next to the water fountain. And he would always be at the water fountain looking at me. So it didn't take long, you know, to see that this young man liked me, and I was friends with his sister. So we all hung together and we rode the bus together. And then eventually over a period of time, he asked me to sit next to him on the bus. So we would sit next to each other on the bus, and we did play basketball together and rode bikes together. So we did things that, you know, 10, 11 and 12 year olds did. And then, you know, as we got a little bit older, maybe a little bit too young, but a little bit older, we liked each other. We were girlfriend and boyfriend, as you would have it. John would ride me on the handlebars of his bike, and we would sneak off to the local gas station to get a bottle of Pepsi, and we would share peanut chews. And then he would drive me back home because I wasn't allowed to go to the gas station, but we did. We went to the gas station to get our treats, and he used to tell me, I just like you to sit on the handlebars so I could watch or I could smell your hair, because your hair was long and it always used to blow in my face. And so he's very sweet. That's how we met. We met as kids, and we dated into our teenage years, our young tween years. And then, you know, our families separated. My parents separated. They divorced and we moved away. And ultimately his parents parted ways as well. So we lost touch. And fast forward into our adult years, back in 2016, early 2016, his sister reached out to me. His sister found me and reached out to me and asked me if I would write a letter of commutation for John. And I was like, what is that? Like, I had no idea what that was. And she said, well, you know, you've known Johnny for the longest, like you knew him as a kid. And we were wondering if you would write a letter as to what you remember about you guys as children. And I said, sure. So I took about 4 days and I wrote a letter about John. I dug down into my soul, and, you know, and then at that point, that's when I started to learn everything. You know, once I wrote the letter, I sent it to her, And she called me crying a few days later, and she said, "You really do know him so well. Mm-hmm. Can John wants to know if he can call you?" And I said, "Absolutely." And I said, "Well, what is going on with John?" And she said, "Well, I'd rather him tell you." So I knew he was in prison, and then I heard what it was about, and my first reaction was, "No way, not John. This is a fluke. You know, eventually they'll straighten it out and he'll come home, because that's just not John." And that was my first thought and my only thought. And so eventually, as time would have it, he called me about a few days later. We talked, and he told me, "You know, if you ever want to come and visit me, you can visit me. You're on my visiting list." And I was like, okay. So a couple of weeks later, I found myself driving down the Pennsylvania Turnpike. I really hadn't thought of going to see him that day. I was coming from somewhere else. And it was the anniversary of my father's birthday, which was June 4th, 2016. And my father passed away the same year Johnny's mother passed away. I found that out later on. I ended up going to the prison, and I had the visit. John didn't expect me. And when I got there, John was just amazed. I mean, he just ran over to me and he picked me up, and we just talked, and he said, "What are you doing? I can't believe you came." And I said, "You know, they didn't have my right address. You know," I said, "What address did you give them?" He said, "Karen, you have been on the list since the first day I walked in here." He said, "You were the first name I put on the visiting list, and I put your old home address and your old phone number because that's all I could remember." And he said, "And you know, I'm so happy that you came to see me today." And he said, "I've only prayed for two things since I've been inside. And of course, the first thing is that for my freedom." And he said, "And the second thing is that one day I would see you before I die." He said, "In my dreams, my prayer and my dreams came true when I saw you walk through that door." And he said, "And I know I'm coming home. I know that God answers prayer, and I'm coming home." And we just continued to talk and communicate, and I would go visit. And I just started visiting him every week and wanting to know more and more, because it was just horrible to leave him on those Sundays that I would visit. And I just said, "Johnny, what can I do? You're here. What can we do? This is crazy." And at this point, it was like 26 years. And he said, "Well, you know, I've got this habeas corpus in that I'm working on, and we're working on the commutation." I said, "But what else can I do?" And he said, "I'd like my story to be told." And I said, "Okay, well, maybe I can do something." So I said, "I think they have these petitions." And so I started the petition on change.org. And that was against the advice of the person doing his commutation paperwork. But John said, "No, I want to have that. I want to tell my side. I want to get my story out." And the change.org petition was slow in starting. But after a while, after a few months, a advocate from California, her name is Sabra, reached out to me through the petition and said, "This seems crazy." She said, "Can whoever the owner of this petition or the author of this petition, could you please reach out to me? I'd like to help." So I called her, and in fact, she ended up helping me. You have to get the transcripts. You have to read through the transcripts, dissect them. You have to develop a list of witnesses and start investigating these witnesses, find out who's alive, who's dead, what their significance is. And it took months and into years of work, and we're still working on that part, but she helped me. I flew out to California, and I basically learned from her how to organize everything. And that's pretty much how things got started for John and I.
Now, Now, Colin, I know that you have reported other cases where there's a spouse or a close family member that is also advocating for the defendant to have a conviction overturned. But Karen is also a very skilled investigator. How has that helped you as you've been putting this podcast episodes together?
I mean, it's helped me tremendously. I've been able to reach out to her anytime I have a question about the materials in the case or there's a witness I want to track down. And she's very diligent and persistent and will do everything she can. And so she's certainly helped to set up interviews for me that we've been able to use the audio on the podcast.
Hmm. Now, Craig or Karen, I'd love for either one of you to answer this. In episode 3, a woman named Sandy Wilson seems to have been a witness who initially seemed like she would help John but ended up hurting him. I'll start with you, Craig. Can you remind us of who she is and give us an update on efforts to locate her and determine what's going on with her prison records?
Yeah, Sandy Wilson, again, was one of the 6 women who John's trial attorney moved to present a trial. And, you know, the district attorney's office objected. So they had a pretrial suppression hearing, and these women testified, Sandy being one. So Sandy was available on, it was June. I know it wasn't July, but she testified. She was available. She was in court. And she said she saw Sharon that night at the apartment complex and in front of the tree, which corroborates what Kathy Rollins is saying, that she saw blood on, what she believed to be blood on Sharon's hands.
Hmm.
Now, fast forward to trial, and she's mysteriously goes missing. And so, you know, under the legal rules, if your opponent had the ability to confront the witness and the witness is now quote unquote unavailable, they can introduce her testimony. That's what they did. And which is fine because that testimony got before the jury. The jury heard that here's a woman that saw Sharon that night about the time of the murder with blood on her hands. And she couldn't answer any potential questions about whether she was in fact in jail that night because on rebuttal, the state, the Commonwealth presented a witness who ran the local county jail that said, oh no, this Sandy Wilson couldn't have seen what she claims to have seen because this Sandy Wilson was in jail on the night of the murder and so forth. So again, I have not talked to Sandy Wilson, no, Karen has. And based on what Karen has told me that Sandy has said is that they picked her up at some point and they were holding her somewhere during trial. Karen, you want to pick up on that?
Yes, yes. I believe, well, Sandy Wilson gave a pretrial testimony in June of 92, and she was to appear in court July of 92.
Yeah.
There is a newspaper article which also confirms that she had told the newspaper that someone put a gun to her chest and told her not to testify. So pretty much what we've learned is that she didn't show up. We figured she just got scared. And I went to her home October of last year. I didn't know if she lived there or not. I just found the latest address and I went and I drove there and her husband answered the door and she had just had knee surgery. So I went inside and she knew exactly who I was. And we sat down for a few minutes and talked. And she said, oh, you want to talk about John Brookins? I know who you are. And I said, yeah. I said, well, how are you? And we talked. And then she said, let's go outside. So she wobbled out to the porch to have a cigarette. And when we sat out there, she said, I don't really want to talk too much. I can't talk too much in front of my husband. He doesn't want me to bring up my past. It will upset him. But what do you want to know? I said, I want to know why you didn't go to the trial. Why weren't you there to tell what you saw? She said, Karen, they picked me up and they took me to a safe house. That was her exact words. They took me to a safe house. And I said, what is a safe house? She said, I don't know where it was, but it was like a hotel room. And all I can remember is that the police were standing outside my door and they brought me food and they were nice to me. She said, but I do remember talking to a woman and the guy through a teleprompter. And I don't really know what that means.
Hmm.
But she said, I was there a couple of days and then they let me go.
Colin, does this make any sense to you, this version of Sandy Wilson's story?
I mean, it's certainly odd, but there's a lot of oddities in this case, including Eastlack girls and...
Yes, we're going to talk about that.
Yeah. We heard about, you know, Eastlack and the other detectives apparently threatening other witnesses not to testify. So, I mean, I would say nothing is out of the question in this case. I haven't been able to corroborate with Sandy Wilson, which is why I don't, you know, have an interview with her on the podcast. But certainly, I would love to at some point speak with her and get her story on the record.
Now, Colin, was Sandy Wilson the witness who there's potentially a second Sandy Wilson out there?
Correct.
With a different prison record that the state is basically saying is the same Sandy Wilson, but the I think it was Karen who said the pictures don't match and it's definitely a different person.
Yes, John remembers seeing a photograph some time ago where there was a woman's picture labeled Sandra Wilson, dark-skinned and thin. The real Sandy Wilson is a lighter-skinned and a little bit fuller in the face, a little bit chunkier. So
wow.
They definitely don't look like the same person.
Hmm. Craig, we heard a lot about the DNA petition in episode 4. What is the current status of that?
Well, we filed it last June of 19, and there were a flurry of responsive pleadings filed last September and October. It was denied by the post-conviction court, which is the trial court in Pennsylvania. And the trial court denied it on two grounds. One, that it was untimely, and two, that the theory of innocence we articulated wasn't really a theory of innocence because the Commonwealth could charge John as a co-conspirator. So let me flesh those two out. You know, Pennsylvania's DNA testing statute it's not a thing of beauty in the way it's written, because in one of the first sections of the statute, it says the petitioner can file a DNA testing motion at any time. But then you fast forward down to the section of the statute where the trial court has to make a determination whether to grant testing. And one of the factors the trial court has to consider is whether the motion was timely filed. Right. So it's sort of conflicting. And there's not much case law on it in Pennsylvania. There's one case, a capital case, which actually I worked on when I was at the Innocence Project, the Steve Edmondson case. But that was a very fact-specific case arguing that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court said that Steve Edmonston petition DNA motion was untimely. So the judge said, yeah, it's been 28 years, it's untimely. And the other thing, and I think Colin touched on this in part 4, is the transformation of the Commonwealth theory of the case. And it's quite remarkable. And at trial, it was simply John Brookins murdered Sheila Ginsburg and nobody else. I mean, there was a comment early on in the trial where the DA mentioned something about the people who killed Sharon, but literally it was one sentence, but all the other pleadings, direct appeal, John's initial post-conviction, the federal habeas petition, there's some great language in there from the DA's office saying that John Brookins and only John Brookins murdered Sheila Ginsburg. So, I mean, my theory was innocence. If John's conviction, if the jury's verdict is based on the belief that John Brookins and only John Brookins murdered Sheila Ginsburg, then finding Sharon's DNA on multiple items of incriminating evidence would prove his quote-unquote actual innocence. No reasonable fact finder would vote to convict. Well, when the Commonwealth saw that argument, they're like, well, you know, we've never said that Sharon didn't do it. So even if Sharon's DNA is found on these items, it simply means there was a conspiracy between Sharon and John, which is absurd. Because,
yeah.
I mean, if anybody has any idea how to prove conspiracy, you have to prove there's an agreement. And the way this murder happened, there was no agreement. Whoever murdered Sheila did so in a rage, blitz attack. There was no, I mean, just straight up, there was no real planning. And the conspiracy, for the most part, requires some sort of planning. So long story short, it got denied on those two grounds. We are currently appealing it. We filed our briefs. in the spring, it went to the panel on June 21st. So it's still pending before the panel. So it's been there about 4 months, and generally takes 4 to 6 months for the Superior Court of Pennsylvania to issue its opinion. So, and with the pandemic, I don't know what how that will impact it, but I know when the Innocence Project is involved, in which we have the Innocence Project, and we have Georgetown, I know I'm fairly confident the Superior Court's going to take a long, hard look at all the briefing.
Yeah. So am I correct in guessing, as I did on social media the other day, that for all the work that prosecutions and states put into going to court over requests for DNA tests, is it not a lot cheaper just to do a DNA test than it is to fight one for months or years?
Well, you know, when I was a staff attorney at the Innocence Project, the first, so when we would take a, we would have our intake meetings, I would get assigned, you know, each attorney at the project has different states to divvy up the states amongst the staff attorneys, and I had my states. So once we accepted the case, it would then be revealed what state it was from. And then if it was my state, the first thing I would do with my law student who was assigned to the case, I would sit down and write a consent letter to the DA's office saying, look, we just accepted this. Here's our theory of innocence. The Innocence Project is paying for all testing. So there's no burden on whatever county this case is out of on those taxpayers in that county. And I did the same thing in John's case. I wrote Matt Weibel. What is it? Matt, what's
Weintraub.
His name? Weintraub. I wrote Matt Weintraub. And again, I pulled up an old consent letter I'd written from the Innocence Project. I tweaked it. I added the facts of John's case. And I said, look, the Innocence Project has agreed to sign on. They've agreed to pay for all DNA testing. So there's nothing coming out of Bucks County's pocket if DNA testing is granted. And a lot of my cases were resolved that way. And I mean, prosecutors would read it and they'd say, all right, let's do it. And, you know, honestly, the first 10 cases I sent to testing at the Innocence Project came back to my client. So, I mean, for a long time there, I was the Incrimination Project, not the Innocence Project. But a lot of those were consent cases, and which you just boom, boom, boom. Like my first exoneration, Lawrence McKinney, literally, it was a Shelby County case out of Tennessee. And I convinced the prosecutor, John Campbell, at the time, to consent. And we did testing fairly quickly in that. Here we could have done testing already.
Yeah.
Could have been, I mean, let's answer the question that everybody wants to know. Is Sharon Ginsburg's DNA on these items of evidence? And it, we're picking up a dime. Nobody right. from Bucks County has to pay a cent.
Colin, I find it so frustrating that, you know, when we have a story like this, and this is the same situation somewhat as in the Adnan Syed case, where the defendant, the whole burden is on the defendant to do this whole process, right? To file things on time, to prove that there could be a claim of innocence based on all of these technical factors. Meanwhile, the state can hang their whole case on a theory of crime at trial and, like, literally build a timeline around and an evidentiary ladder around a theory of a crime. But a court can just say, well, you know, that theory doesn't have to be the theory. It just seems like that's just a huge advantage the state has that the defendant does not have in this kind of process.
Yeah, I mean, that's why this episode was entitled Transformation, is you see this in case after case where there's a clear theory presented at trial. Here is our narrative. Here's our timeline. Here's how we believe this crime went down. And then all of a sudden it gets to appeal and the state says, well, wait a second. We could have done this. We could have done that. And in this case, it's just ridiculous. I mean, the entire defense theory is Sharon Ginsburg did this, not John Brookins. And the state is doing everything and bending over backwards to prove no, Sharon Ginsburg was not involved. And for them to come in now and say testing is meaningless, if it points to Sharon, that points to John as well, it just doesn't add up. And the testing in this case absolutely should move forward.
Now, Karen, what is the current status of the Board of Pardons hearing that John is supposed to have? I know that COVID-19 affected that, right?
Right. Right now, John is waiting for a video interview, a conference with Department of Corrections Secretary Wetzel. And then from there, he's gotten the approval of the institution. And then it goes on to the commutation area where they then set a date. They set a date for him to have a merit review.
Hmm. Now, Craig, we heard about your trip to Florida to talk to Sharon. Great tape, by the way, and you're telling that story. Colin tells me there was something having to do with the FBI that was left on the cutting room floor of the script. What can you tell us about that?
You know, I have a graduate degree in forensic science, and I live with two of my graduate school roommates are now FBI agents. So I have, you know, I'm a fan of the FBI to a certain extent. So I wore my FBI shirt, and then this has FBI in the patch. And it's the middle of June. It's a T-shirt. And so I wear it. And when we approached Sharon, she thought I was with the FBI. But I made clear that I'm like, no, I'm not with the FBI. Here's my business card. I represent John Brookins. But what tipped me off that the DA had spoken to Sharon was the fact that the DA's office wrote that in their response of pleadings of how I approached Sharon and tried to portray myself as an FBI agent.
Huh.
And which is telling, because also in the state's, the Commonwealth's response was the fact that me and Paul Cialino had gone back to Sharon's apartment three times the next day. And I didn't put that when in my initial pleading petition, I didn't put any of that. So that told me a couple things. A, that Sharon has talked to the DA's office. Two, Sharon was there, or somebody was there watching Paul and I each time we approached her apartment.
Yeah.
Right? How would she know that me and Paul came back three different times? Right? She either had to be in another apartment scoping out the place, or she had to have somebody say, oh yeah, these guys came back three different times, like a neighbor or somebody. But she was definitely not, I mean, when we talked to her the night before, you know, you heard the conversation from the episode, she was like, yeah, I'll give it to her. I didn't kill my mother. And I'm like, Sharon, I didn't say you killed your mother. So, you know, Paul and I, when we got back in the car, I was optimistic, but I'll be honest. I told Paul, I'm like, there's no way in hell she's giving us that DNA.
Yeah,
we'll go
yeah.
back. But my gut was, once I saw her expression and her body language and her trembling as I was describing the murder to her, I knew, like, she's not going to give it to us because she knows what's going to happen.
Hmm. And you weren't tempted at all to, like, go through her trash the way they do?
Well, that's the one thing I forgot to mention is at the time when I turned the corner, Paul and I turned the corner to her apartment building, she was standing there. And again, she made a comment about me and, like, wanting to get with me, quote unquote, and funny. And like I said, I go to Paul, Mike, I think that's her. And so, again, we go back to the car, check the photograph, and we realize it's her. But as she was standing, she was smoking a cigarette. And she had a little bowl outside their house. You know, they'll go out and smoke it and put a big-ass ashtray, pardon my language, and put the cigarette butts out. So the cigarette, this whatever you want to call it, ashtray, was outside the night before.
Hmm.
Do you think the ashtray was outside the next day when Paul and I went back?
Are you kidding? She probably brought the ashtray inside. Ugh.
First thing Paul noticed.
It's like a piece of furniture. It's not something you bring out and put in. You leave it outside.
The first thing Paul mentioned was it's gone.
And wow.
Because, yeah, we're like, look, if it's still there, obviously let's help ourselves.
Yeah.
And it's discarded and there's no expectation of privacy, obviously, and I'm not the state. So it's not a Fourth Amendment search. So, but yeah, it was gone. It was not there. And that and just everything collectively, like I said on the fourth episode, I'll go to my grave knowing that Sharon Ginsburg murdered her mother.
Yeah, that's quite a detail. Karen, I'm curious, given everything we've heard in this series pointing to Sharon, I mean, we have multiple people saying that she said she did it under credible circumstances. She told people, apparently, that she did it. And, you know, there's motive, there's opportunity, all the pieces are there. We're comfortable enough that she did it that we're saying she did it in a broadcast. I mean, that says a lot, right? I'm curious, like, why do you think the jury convicted John?
The number one reason I feel that the jury convicted John was because they didn't have the facts.
Hmm.
They weren't presented with the facts. if any of the jurors were listening to the podcast, they would get more facts now, way more facts than they got during the trial. So number one, I believe that that's the main reason why they convicted him. Hmm. It was an all-white jury. I believe 102 jurors were polled. And out of 102, there were two African-Americans. And of course, one was dismissed. She was a young Black woman. And Diane Gibbons said she didn't like the way she looked at John.
Hmm.
She said she looked at him. She looked at the defendant. So she dismissed that juror. And then the other African-American juror, he had some instance, I think, where he had something racially motivated on his lawn at one time, and he had an interaction with the police about it. And so they dismissed him for that. And I'll speak candidly from the research that I've done. Some of the jurors are very questionable. One of the jurors worked for the printing company that prints the forms for all of Bucks County for the police departments. And he admitted to knowing some of the police officers. Another juror was the wife of a man who worked for the VFW, who managed the VFW that Sheila frequented. That's questionable to me. And two other jurors agreed that they had an issue with racism. So to me, those are questionable.
Yeah. I think racism is probably a good answer here. I mean, it's something, a story we see over and over again. There's data to support it. And that doesn't sound great. I mean, dismissing potential jurors because they're Black, as we've heard in many other cases, is a pervasive problem. And it sounds like that's what happened here. Craig, this is a very complicated case. It was condensed into four tight episodes of Undisclosed. Was there something that wasn't included in the podcast that you want listeners to know about?
God, that's a good question. Because you guys covered most of the important details that I think the public needs to know about. I think the facts speak for themselves, and I think you guys did a good job. Because when you hear that, and again, when I first met Karen, I said to Karen, I've never reviewed a case where defense counsel was able to present six witnesses to say that somebody else did it. And that evidence is coming from that person's own mouth. It's not like circumstantial evidence to say, well, maybe he or she did do it, but these are people who said that Sharon Ginsburg either explicitly or strongly implied that she, in fact, murdered her mother.
Hmm.
So, I mean, that you don't have that. How many? Ask Colin. I don't know how many cases you guys have reviewed, but you don't get that. You don't get people. That's like a windfall of evidence for the defense. So. And you guys have done a good job presenting that and all the other oddities and injustices that have permeate throughout John's case. And so hopefully we can get DNA testing. Hopefully maybe John can get a commutation in the meantime. But no, you guys have done a tremendous amount of work and a great job covering John's case. So I really appreciate it. And then I know John does too, and Karen does.
Karen, since you are in many ways the lead investigator on this case for many years, I'm going to give you a chance to answer a listener question. Jennifer wrote this question. She's curious about the layout of the apartment building, the crime scene. And you've been there, right?
Yes.
And you're OK. So she wants to know where Sheila's apartment was in regards to Mary's apartment, the laundry room, Margaret Albright's apartment. What was the orientation like? What is it feasible? I think she's getting to that there would have been this overhearing of this struggle and this argument inside of the apartment.
OK, so the apartment is a long building, but it's divided in two sections. And I believe there's a firewall in between, but the laundry room downstairs on the bottom floor connects both sides of the building on the left of Sheila's apartment. Sheila's is on the bottom floor, which is like, let's consider the basement. And then the second floor would be right above Sheila was Mary Davis or Mary Dredge. And right next door to Mary Davis and Mary Dredge was a gentleman by the name of Roy Jennings. And then above them, there's a third floor apartment. There is no apartment directly across from Sheila. It's just a wall. And then if you go outside and you go to the left and walk down the courtyard and make a left into the other half of the building, that's where you would have the apartments that hold Mark Albright Chevelle Durant, who lived right next door to Margaret Albright on the second floor. Mary Dredge mentions that she could hear Sheila's TV at times through the floor of the apartment. Yet Mary Dredge also states that she was walking up and down the steps at between 11 and 12 into the laundry room. Yet she heard nothing. And it's just impossible for Margaret Albright to have heard anything. Number one, it didn't happen during that time. And if anything, anybody was going to hear anything, it definitely would have been Mary Davis or Mary Dredge, and who would have ran to her friend's assistance. Sheila was her good friend. So that's the best I could answer that.
No, that's really helpful. Maybe you could draw a diagram and send it to Colin and he could tweet it out to answer that question.
Well, I'll definitely do that.
We got a question from Carly, which I believe we answered. She wanted to know why it was taking so long to follow up on the testing motion for the DNA. I believe that we covered that. I have a question. This is from Rebecca at Reb Lavoy on Twitter. WTF with the cop running in the sex trafficking operation. Colin, is this definitely true?
I think Karen or Craig might be a better person to answer that.
What can you guys tell me about this alleged sex trafficking operation being run by this police officer in this case?
I'll defer to Karen. Karen's been in Bristol for years. And obviously there are people making this allegation.
Yeah.
And I mean, I don't find it an unreasonable allegation based on how this case was investigated. But what do you know?
Yeah, I was born and raised in this area. And unbeknownst to me, because I wasn't aware of it at that time, of course, because I didn't travel in those circles. But after the case, because of me being in the area, people would approach me once they started to realize that John, I was involved in John's case. They would approach me no matter where I was, in the grocery store, the church parking lot, anywhere. People would run into me and they would say, you know, that Al Eastlack, he was running a drug and prostitution ring, you know, and that, you know, the Ballpark Tavern is where all the hookers were. And that's where he was and all of his guys were. And though, you know, those guys are dirty cops. Do you know what they did to me? And then I had drug dealers. I had ex drug dealers approach me and tell me they're not drug dealers anymore. I want to specify that. But the words they would say is they would run up in our house. They would run up in my house and take whatever they wanted, or say, you're going to give me $5,000 or you're going to jail today. And they would extort them. And there was one gentleman that I talked to also. He reached out to me. He called me because he saw the petition and he said, you know, that Al Eastlack gave my brothers and I a hard time all the time, but he threatened me and told me to stay away from his girls. And I was like, what girls? He goes, you know, the Ballpark Tavern girls. Those were his girls. Those were his prostitutes.
Wow.
So there were many people, countless people, and maybe one day I'll write out a list of everyone that ever told me that. But I wish I had $100 for each one.
Final question for you, Karen. Obviously, we hear John's voice quite a bit on the podcast, but is there anything that you think he would like listeners to know about his case, about how he's doing, that you could share with us?
Well, John is extremely, extremely grateful. When I heard, and I just have to stop for a moment and just thank you guys for the wonderful job that you've done. This is basically a dream come true for him. Like I said, he's always wanted to tell his story and for someone that cared to listen. And my hat's off to Colin, to Rabia, and to Susan Simpson, and you, Rebecca, and everyone behind the scenes, and Craig as well. John is very thankful. He's hopeful. He remains hopeful. But he just wants people to know that that he's innocent, and all he wants to do is come home. He doesn't want to fight for the rest of his life. He just wants to come home. He prays every day that he makes it out of there. John is immunocompromised. So with COVID lurking around now, that's just a new fight we have every single day. And we pray. John is big on prayer. He's big on meditation. He slows me down. In the 15 minutes that we talk each day now, it's about relax, let's pray, let's give thanks to God. And he believes that all of this is a journey. There is no reason. He doesn't know the reason for the journey, but he just knows that this is his journey. He's thankful that I'm on this journey with him, and I'm thankful that I'm on this journey with him because I've got the most amazing man in the world. And we both believe that God brought us back together for this purpose.
Well, Karen Brookins, I really hope that you guys are reunited in person soon. It was a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for joining me on Undisclosed Addendum.
Thank you.
And Craig Cooley, thanks so much for your insights on the case. I look forward to seeing how it all turns out, and good luck to you.
No, thank you. No, I will keep everyone updated.
So, Colin, a couple of things I wanted to talk to you about. One, you know, we didn't discuss beforehand, but I couldn't help but notice in the news a very happy turn of events in the Jonathan Irons case, a case you covered on Undisclosed and that we talked about a lot on the addendum. Maya Moore, the WNBA player who'd been advocating for him, and Jonathan Irons are married. They've gotten married. What did you think when you heard that news?
I wasn't surprised. It's funny, when I was recording the interviews with Jonathan and Maya, and I told my wife after listening to them back for the podcast, you know, I think there's something there. I think if he gets out,
yeah,
something might happen.
Too.
And some listeners said that too on Twitter. And yeah, so it wasn't a surprise. So congratulations to both Jonathan and Maya. It's great news for the two of them.
It is great news. And I honestly, between us and everybody else, thought exactly the same thing. I'm like, I think she loves him. You could kind of hear it a little bit. And it's just such a wonderful story. And seeing the photos of them together is just so incredible. But I wanted to follow up with you because we have some more material here for the listeners to hear. In episode 4 of the Brookins series, you mentioned the case of Purvis Payne, whose execution is scheduled for December 3rd. What can you tell us about the status of his case?
Yeah, so as we mentioned, Purvis Payne, very similar case to this one. He's an African-American man in Tennessee. He says he comes upon an attacked woman who's Caucasian. He starts to try to help. He realizes the optics of it. He runs away. He's convicted of the murder. And so, yeah, his execution is scheduled for December 3rd, and his attorneys have asked for clemency from the governor in Tennessee. And so here is an interview that I did with his attorney, Kelly Henry.
All right, let's listen to that.
If I can take you back to June 1987, what is the crime in this case?
So June 27th, 1987, Cherise Christopher and her children, Lacey and Nicholas, were murdered in their home in Millington, Tennessee, in their apartment. They were stabbed to death brutally by, you know, a person who, you know, I believe we still don't know who was.
Right. And there's some forensic evidence that shows that Purvis Payne was in their apartment, but according to him, the reason he was there is what?
So Purvis was at the apartment building to check on his girlfriend who lived across the hall from Miss Christopher. He was planning to spend the weekend with her. And so he, you know, came up and knocked on his girlfriend's door. She wasn't home yet. And he heard, you know, the muffled sound of Miss Christopher, who was still alive. And he went to investigate and came upon the crime scene and tried to help. So Purvis's testimony was that he observed the murder weapon, the knife, in the neck of Miss Christopher, sticking out of her neck, and he removed the knife, thinking that that would somehow be helpful, and then realized that, you know, he was a young black man in this apartment, in this murder scene. He was the only one there. They were white. A white police officer arrives, and he panics and runs.
Right. And other than the forensic evidence that shows he was in the apartment, is there anything else that implicates Purvis Payne in this crime?
There really isn't. And when you say forensic evidence, you know, there are real questions about, you know, they say his fingerprints are on some beer cans in the apartment. And there are questions about whether or not those beer cans were actually planted in the apartment. In fact, the notes in the prosecutor's file when he's preparing for trial, he's like, you know, how, there's so many discrepancies about the beer cans, where they came from, how they got there. Just a lot of questions about the integrity of this investigation, where we know that the bodies were moved before photographs were taken. Evidence was moved before photographs were taken. Photographs that allegedly were in the color camera that they had to borrow from their chief of police because they didn't own their own color camera. They claimed that they forgot to put film in it. I mean, there's just all sorts of questions, you know?
And that ties into your recent DNA motion, which was granted. And so why is this DNA testing potentially so important in this case?
You know, it could exonerate Purvis. It could lead to you know, finding a male DNA profile that is someone other than Purvis. There's a lot of evidence to be tested, a lot of evidence that still exists. Unfortunately, the best evidence, the evidence that, you know, would most likely have perpetrator DNA on it, has vanished. And that is problematic. The victim's clothing, the vaginal swabs taken from the victim, all gone. And the fingernail scrapings of the victim, which the district attorney general in July, when we filed our motion for testing, in their motion opposing testing, they said that the fingernail scrapings were still in existence. And then when we went to the hearing on September 1st, no one knew where they were. And there's no chain of custody. Yeah, so that is troubling, to say the least. But, you know, it's possible that we can get you know, male DNA from the items of evidence that do still exist. That could point to someone other than Mr. Payne. I mean, we know Mr. Payne's DNA is going to be there because he was there. He said he was there. But, you know, if we can find, you know, the true perpetrator's DNA, that would obviously be exonerating.
Right. And so that's one matter that's currently pending. Obviously, the execution is scheduled for December 3rd. The other is you've just filed with the governor of Tennessee for a form of clemency, right? And that's at least partially based upon Mr. Payne having intellectual disability?
Correct.
And so what's the nature of his intellectual disability?
So Purvis's intellectual disability is that his IQ measures, you know, between 68 and 72. He has you know, adaptive behavior deficits that are, you know, documented throughout his childhood. He had difficulties in school. He was not able to graduate. You know, so his intellectual disability is well established through two expert reports, including, you know, one expert that Dr. Dan Martell, who this district attorney general's office has relied on in the past, including in the Robert Coe case. So a frequent expert for the state has concluded that he has intellectual disability, and that evidence is simply unassailable. The problem is, Tennessee won't provide a procedure for Purvis to get into court. So the, you know, the U.S. Supreme Court said in Atkins versus Virginia that it is unconstitutional to execute the intellectually disabled, partially because they're at a special risk for wrongful execution, and that it's, you know, states are forbidden from executing people with intellectual disability, but you have to be adjudicated intellectually disabled. So even though we know as a factual matter that he is, he can't access the courts to be adjudicated because of these procedural technicalities in Tennessee law. And so we have asked the governor basically to fix that, which is broken in the system, and commute his sentence to life, because that is what would happen if he could access the courts.
Right. And for our listeners hearing about this case, very similar facts to the case we've been presenting on the podcast, very little evidence that implicates Mr. Payne in this crime, DNA evidence that could prove his innocence, intellectual disability. And as you say, you're asking for the governor to commute his sentence to a life sentence, and he has this pending execution on December 3rd. What's the best way that our listeners can help in the effort for that commutation?
So there are a couple of things that we're asking people to do, action items. One is to call and write the governor's office, the governor of Tennessee, Governor Lee. We're asking folks to go to purposepain.org and sign up to show your support for Purvis. We already have over 130,000 supporters that have signed up on that website. It will also provide your listeners additional information about the case, and then they'll get email updates as to what's going on. Sign up on the Facebook page, Justice for Purvis Payne, to keep abreast, and to share information about this case through all their social media networks. I don't understand TikTok because I'm a certain age, but there have been many a TikTok out there about this case, and that's great. Spreading news amongst young people about this injustice, you know, through TikTok, through Instagram, through Facebook, through Twitter, just getting that message out there so that more people will write to Governor Lee to tell him that this is what he should do, that he should commute Purvis Payne's sentence because he shouldn't be on death row to begin with, and there's just too much doubt in his case.
All right, Colin, how can listeners contact Governor Bill Lee to ask for clemency in this case?
Yeah, so listeners, you can say this is a case of a man with intellectual disability. There's DNA evidence that has not been tested, that is missing, that you have questions and concerns about whether he's guilty or innocent. You can reach Governor Bill Lee to ask for a commutation to a life sentence by calling. It's 615-741-2001. Or there's a form on his website to send an email, www.tn.gov/governor/contact-us.html.
Will you share that on your Twitter account, perhaps, so listeners can find it easily, Colin?
Yes, there will be a call to action on Twitter for people to contact the governor to ask for a commutation.
Well, I will certainly be filling out that form myself. Thank you so much for sharing it and sharing that interview about Purvis Payne's case. And thank you so much for sharing with everyone, including me, the story of John Brookins. It's really been a fascinating case to hear about, and I hope to hear news on it soon.
All right, great. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Colin. And if you're wondering what you can do to help John Brookins out, you can go to the website, bringbrookinshome.com. You can look at all the links there, including links to purchase merchandise that will help pay for a new investigator in his case. We'll post all the links to help John Brookins out and help Purvis Payne out in the show notes for this episode. So if you want to take a look there, you can get all the information that you need to help out with those cases. And if you have questions about any of the cases we've covered on Undisclosed, you can always ask them on social media, and we will do our best to answer them here on The Addendum. Just look for Undisclosed Pod on all the platforms. Now, production for The Addendum is done by the brilliant Hannah McCarthy. And if you want to hear more of me, check out my True Crime Review podcast. It's called Crime Writers On. Thanks so much to executive producer Methil Telhan and to Colin, Rabia, and Susan for continuing to let me be a part of your important work. For everyone at Undisclosed, thanks so much for listening. More to come in 2 weeks.